Greetings, this is Nigeria Anderson, and you are UrbanBuzzMag.com. And I have jazz recording artist extraordinaire Gordon Goodwin on the line with me, and he is promoting a new project called Forella 2. It has 2 Grammy noms. We're excited about that. Gordon, jump in and say hello and tell us a little bit about this project.
Nigeria, how you doing? Good to speak with you. And you're excited. Boy, you wouldn't believe it. But I'm most excited for Patty Austin.
Okay.
If you've ever heard Ella Fitzgerald, and there's been nobody to equal her in terms of her musicianship and her ability to improvise like a saxophone player, but she does it with her voice. It goes beyond being a good singer. You really have to be a knowledgeable musician. And Ella showed everybody how to do it.
Come on.
And there's been nobody till Patty. Who is heir apparent to Ella Fitzgerald. She's the perfect person to do a tribute to Ella because she lives there. Now, you're talking about somebody who also, you know, had pop hit back in the day. You know, she's Quincy Jones' goddaughter, so she, you know, she's got the genes. And she had the How Do You Keep the Music Playing, a hit with James Ingram back in the day. Baby Come to Me was another one. A bunch of hits that were more pop music.
Right.
But lurking in her DNA was this jazz and bebop core. Mm-hmm. And when she sings this music, you know, a lot of times jazz can be mysterious to some people if you're not used to it.
Right.
A lot of notes, you know, and a lot of complex harmonies and things. And yet Patty has a way of singing that stuff in a way that it connects. It doesn't sound pedantic or overly complicated or elitist when she does it. So You don't even have to be a jazz fan to listen to her sing this material and connect with it.
Right.
You know, in a meaningful way. We've been friends for probably 20 years. And when she called and asked if I wanted to write the arrangements and work with her on the project, you know, I mean, it was just, let's go.
Right. A no-brainer.
Yeah. And here's the other thing about Patty. She is absolutely Richard Pryor level funny. He is funny. And that's the problem. Sometimes, because she'll start riffing and doing bits, and we're laughing so hard that we're not getting any work done. We'll be on a working for an hour, not even have written a note because she's just doing her thing.
Right.
And it's really really an incredible thing. So I'm so happy for her that she's got this nomination, and it was an honor, you know, to work on a project with Patty.
Well, I hope you guys win, and we know that, you know, they say our voice is our first instrument. And so how does she accompany her instrument with the instruments?
That's a great question because there's nothing that throws her. I'm doing an arrangement for her of an Ella Fitzgerald song. We did a version of Get Happy, but she wanted to do it gospel style.
Oh, wow.
Ella did it kind of in a different thing. So we kind of just went to church with it, you know, and we brought in, you know, a bunch of background singers, kind of a choir and everything. And I wrote some lines in the saxophones and the trumpets that were supposed to just be kind of accompanying kind of things in the background. And she heard that, and she latched onto it and started to incorporate it in what she does. And in other words, she approaches it like she's almost another instrument in the orchestra.
Wow.
Not singer standing in front of the band as the star. She's one of the guys. She's like a member of the group, if you will. Her musicianship allows her to step back as other guys in the band we have there. In the top 1% of all jazz musicians on the planet.
Right.
But Patty can tell them what's up, you know?
Right.
She can, and they respect her for that. So that's one of the things that I love about her. She's a unit in the band. She's not like the superstar up in the front and the band's kind of just backing her up. So I'll write something in the arrangement, and it doesn't throw her for a minute. She grabs onto it and incorporates it in her vocal. Did I answer your question?
Yes, it did, actually. And it's really good to see the collaboration. Speaking about her, how did you become interested in being a jazz professional?
It started when I was 13.
Wow.
And this is a poignant question for me because the man that introduced me to jazz passed away yesterday.
Right, right.
He was my high school band director. He was 2 weeks shy of his 99th birthday. So he had a rich, full life. But when I was 13, he said, "Hey, kid," and I remember it vividly. I'm in the band room in middle school, and he says, "I need you to listen to this record. This is a record by a man called Count Basie."
Wow.
And I'd never heard of Count Basie. I didn't know what it was.
Right.
And he goes, "I need you to check this out." So he puts it on as a piece, you know, vinyl, and he takes a needle and he drops it on one of the tracks, and my life changed.
Wow.
I don't know why a 13-year-old kid, because, you know, there was really, my parents weren't musicians. Mm. And we had some music in the house, but it wasn't a lot of jazz. Some, you know, maybe like Glenn Miller and Artie Shaw and those guys. But you know, it wasn't really a jazzy household, but this music grabbed me at age 13. And I said, oh, man, I got to do this. I don't know what it is. And so this high school band director, Robin Snyder, he says, look, I want you to write a piece of music for our band and do it like Count Basie. I said, I don't know how to do that. He goes, you figure it out. And he was right. I went home and I just kind of figured it out.
Wow.
So it started really early, you know, and then from age 13 to when I went to college, I was a jazz snob. I hated pop music. I hated classical music. All I wanted to hear was Miles Davis and Cannonball Adderley and, you know, and big bands. And Ellington and Basie and Buddy Rich and all, that was all I was into.
Right.
Then I got to college, and those guys said, "Hold on, yeah, you're not just doing that. You're going to study conducting, and you're going to study orchestration, and you're going to study counterpoint, and you're going to study music history." And I go, "I don't want to study that stuff." And they're like, "Sorry, you want to go to school here? That's what you do." This was before they had jazz majors in the colleges, so I was like, "Oh crap," you know. So, but I did it. I studied that music. And at the same time, I got a gig in a club at night, and we were playing Earth, Wind & Fire and Stevie Wonder and the Beatles and like pop music like that.
Uh-huh.
My head is opening up, not just jazz. I was studying Mozart in the day, and I was playing Earth, Wind & Fire and Stevie Wonder at night. And I hear it, this changed my life because it made me so diverse in terms of what I understood.
Yes.
So the music that I write and the musical here on Fort Ella 2 shows those influences, you know?
Yes.
One tune's kind of a Latin groove, other tune's straight ahead swing, other tune's a gospel groove, one's kind of hip hop funky, you know? So I believe in that. I believe in pushing back the barriers between musical styles. And by the way, parenthetically, pushing back the barriers between human beings. We don't need to have to say that jazz exists between this line and nowhere else. I don't think we need to have human beings defined in the same way. I don't want you to define me by my race or my gender or my politics or any of that stuff. It's like the totality of who I am, right?
Right.
It's what I'm about. I don't want you to look at me as a white man, you know, and
right.
define me that way.
Right, or a white man trying to play jazz.
Right. Now, this is something that I feel really fortunate as I've gotten older and looked at the world and looked how people are identifying themselves by their tribes and by their clubs that they're in and everything. And I always felt a little bit like, am I a member of any club?
Right.
But like musically, I play the piano and I play the saxophone. I write music and I orchestrate music and I can conduct an orchestra because I learned it in college,
right.
You know. And nowadays, there's a whole other thing you have to know. You got to know how to work a computer and samples and
right.
technology. I got to be a recording engineer, you know. And this is, so there's a whole, and by the way, you know what you have to do? You got to know how to promote yourself. You got to go on social media. You got to know, be able to deal with all that stuff. So it's, every one of those things is a full-time job.
Right.
And
yeah, especially being independent. It is a full-time job. I try to explain to people, when you're independent, you said it well, Gordon, it is a full-time job, and you have to be able to put yourself in each component to make the wheel spin.
Yeah, you do. And here's the other thing that they never told me. I'm going to be a jazz musician. They're not going to pay me to do it. Jazz has a 1% market share, maybe.
Wow.
And you want to raise a family? You want to put kids through college? Jazz ain't going to do it.
Mm.
So what do you do? What I ended up doing, because I live in L.A.,
mm-hmm.
and there's all kinds of media, music, and films. And so I did a lot of work, you know, composing and arranging and conducting for movies, you know, things like that. And that pays real money. And take that money and put it into my jazz habit, you know?
Right.
And put my kids through college and do all that stuff. But I had to figure that out because I would look at these older jazz musicians, like two generations ahead of me, and I look at them in their old age and they're broke,
mm-hmm.
and they're destitute.
Wow.
And I wonder, did anyone ever pull those guys aside when they were 30 and say, hey, you better start thinking about your retirement? Because
right.
what would you do, you know, when you're 30? People
right.
talk about your retirement, you just laugh. Come on.
Right.
It's like decades away. I don't care about that. And then you snap your fingers and you're there, you know? So I think that as far as being an independent contractor for whatever your business is, you got to have that engine.
Yeah.
You got to drive your own boat. You got to make it happen. You don't have the security of a corporation that gives you health insurance or gives you a pension, all that stuff. You don't have it.
Right.
But you still need it. So, you know, sometimes you have to be creative in terms of how you provide the material things, you know, for yourself and your family. But you see the playing jazz, you know that they're paying a price.
Right.
To play that music, they pay a price. And so does their family.
Do you think it's we're talking independent, but some have had recording deals. So do you think it's the label as well, not knowing how to properly market? I mean, they know how to market pop and R&B and hip hop, mm-hmm. you know, but it seems like gospel music and jazz falls by the wayside. What are your thoughts?
You're exactly right. They don't really know how to market this music and make it so people can connect with it. And there's a problem that's built into the culture of a jazz musician, because here's the thing, it's hard to play jazz, and most people work their asses off to learn how to do it, and that sometimes leads to an attitude of, well, you come to me, I worked hard to do this, so you need to come to me, or Miles Davis turning his back on the audience, right?
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing, which was fine for him, that was his shtick, you know, and that was good for him, but we can't do that. Can
right,
you imagine Taylor Swift turning her back on her audience, you know?
Right.
And the other thing is production. If you look at pop acts, there's a production value. There's probably more production value than there is musical content, right?
That's good.
With jazz music, it's the opposite. There's very little production value. It's just all about the music. As a matter of fact, with a lot of jazz players, production and marketing are considered unseemly. If you spend any time doing that, that means you're not serious about your art. And that attitude is one of the problems we have, because we have to market our product. We have to make it so it's a real show for the audience. They deserve that.
Right. They
deserve a bunch of guys on the bandstand standing up there going, what do you guys want to play? Well, let's play, let's play blues. Yeah, let's do the, okay. Everybody could, here we go. One, two. Can you imagine that kind of stage weight on a pop show? Come on, you know. So
right.
I get a little worked up about it, you know, because I know the potential of this music.
Right. Yeah, no, you're passionate about it.
And
I mean, the hours mm-hmm. that goes into practice, learning an instrument, playing the instrument, writing mm-hmm. music, you know, it's a classical form. And learning how to combine that with, you know, the guitar, the drums, and everybody's ear having to be in a key that can connect. And so that you can get music. You was talking about your creative process and the diversity of sound, Mozart in the day and Earth, Wind, and Fire at night. And it definitely shows in your music, like songs like I Remember, A Few Good Men, like you said, the Latin song, Shake Your Body, There's the Rub, Sing, Sang, and Sung. When you listen to that, we're hearing all of what you're saying. But what would you consider your sound to be?
You know what? That's my problem, because my sound is all of those things. Because if I'm going to do a song in the style of Earth, Wind, and Fire, I mean, I want to hit that target close
right
to the center. But here's the thing. I'm not Maurice White. I'm not going to ever do it in the way that he does it. So it has to be Gordon's version of it.
I love
and,
it.
And all the different influences I have, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, but I will tell you this. I love music of color and a wide palette of color.
Mm-hmm.
So that means for me, it's meant larger ensembles like big bands, which are like 18 guys, or orchestras, which could be 90 musicians. I love all those tools. Now, having said that, I have a this year, and they're piano duets, just me playing both piano parts.
Wow.
And that was a unique challenge, because normally I've got trumpets and saxes and violins and French horns and all these tools in my toolbox to cause a certain emotion in the music. Now I just have two pianos, right? And I have to find a way to get some variety, you know, and some contour with just those two instruments. And it's a different kind of challenge. It was good for me to do that. But generally speaking, I love a big canvas.
Okay. Now,
I mean, here's the other thing that I love. One more thing before you get off that, if that's okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, if you're a musician, you're spending a lot of time by yourself.
Mm.
You're practicing. You're finding out who you are. And you can't do that with other people in the room. You have to go inward. You have to get quiet and get rid of all the noise and just find yourself. So when you do that, it makes you yearn for connection with people, which is why when I'm on stage and I'm playing with other musicians, it's the most intimate thing that you can do because you're completely open.
Right.
You're giving. If another musician plays something, you know that where comedians or actors improvise and they have a thing called yes and, you know, so if one of the improvisation partners goes, hey, what's that elephant doing in the street? Then your response is not, I don't see an elephant. Your response is, oh yeah, that elephant looks like he's mad or he's got a weird hat on or whatever it is you say. It means you're saying yes to the concept and you're adding to it. And it's the same thing with musicians. If I'm playing musicians and with a bunch of guys and I go, and then the drummer goes, and he picks it up and he passes it on.
Right.
That's a form of acceptance and collaboration. And when musicians do that, and all of a sudden three guys are doing it, or four guys, or five or six musicians, that's when the magic happens.
Right.
When people are open and honest and without ego. And when that happens, and that's what's so great about jazz, because it offers those opportunities for that kind of intimacy. And the audience can feel it when that happens, you know. Once I got the courage to be open, if for a while when I was younger, I just was always pretending I knew more than I did.
Right.
and you know what I mean? So it was nice once I was able to shed that and just say, look, you know, my name's Gordon. Here's what I believe. And if you like me, great. And if you don't like me, well, that's okay too.
Right.
Getting there, it's a bit of a tough climb, but if you can find your way there, it's liberating.
I love it. And you're known for large ensembles. And of course, your tagline is the big fat band. And, you know, learning music and practicing, like you said, as an individual is a task all on its own. So what's the process for you to get an ensemble of 18 players of different instruments on the same page?
Yeah. Oh, man. That's why I didn't do this until I was 40. I didn't think I could do that. What you just said. I didn't think I could convince these musicians to follow me or play my music or show up. The problem that a lot of us have is that if you use musicians that are accomplished, they're in demand, you know, and they make way more money playing films or television or movies or whatever. You're often asking them to lose money to do a gig.
Right.
With the band. So in the early days, I didn't know if I could pull it off. But finally, when I was 40 years old, I remember the moment clearly. I was working at Warner Brothers, and we were scoring animation projects for Steven Spielberg. It was a great gig. I was on the stage at Warner Brothers Studios, and I'm conducting this 40-piece orchestra. And I remember telling myself, what are you doing? Is this it for you? You go to Warner Brothers, and you write music like they want. And then you go to Disney. And you write music like they want. And it's a great, it's a noble way to make a living, but is it what I'm supposed to do? Or do I ever plant my own flag? And so what I did was I went back to age 13 when I fell in love with Count Basie, and I started to write big band music, just for the heck of it, just writing it. Once I got about 10 songs, I called up the best musicians I knew, and I said, would you come to the studio and record these charts? And I paid them. I had a little money. I paid them, you know. A lot of them gave me a deal, which was nice.
Right.
But that was the problem. And that's always been the problem with big bands, by the way, is economically it's just so difficult. Because not only do you have to pay them, you got to put them on an airplane and put them in a hotel. And a lot of times when we get called for a gig, we'll tell them what the salary is for our creative fee. And then I'll say, also though, airfare is this much and hotel is this much. And all of a sudden, you know, I hear a dial tone, you know, because it's just like sometimes the numbers just don't work. If it's a small venue, like 200, they can't sell enough tickets to make the money back.
Right.
So it needs to be like at least 1,000-seat venue so they can have a little money to play with, you know. And sometimes they might go, well, screw this. I'll just get a quartet.
Right. Oh,
I don't need,
okay.
I won't get a big band.
Right.
You know, so we're sometimes up against that. But all this stuff doesn't matter because I had to do it. Nigeria, I realized that at 40 years old, you know, I was like, is there more road behind me than ahead of me? Maybe. Who even knows how many days we have left, right? We don't know.
You said that right.
My brother got cancer when he was 25.
Wow.
And he died at 25. He got his cancer at 20.
What
20-year-old kid gets cancer, right? But it happens.
Right.
And you know what? That informs my awareness every day.
Of course.
I think, well, whatever, if I'm complaining about something about my day, hey, my brother got cancer and he died. So how do you feel now, Gordon? You know?
Right, right.
There are like a billion people that would trade places with you and with me right now.
Right, right.
Right? And so if you can carry that in your heart, carry your gratitude good things in your life.
Yeah.
That really makes a difference. That attitude is you can hear it in my music, you know, it's kind of an inherent positivity. I hear it in Patty. I hear it in her singing. Which is why one of the reasons she and I, you know, were able to connect as well as we did.
Yeah. It eventually paid off. You got Grammy nominations and Grammy. So, you know, it's an investment in what you know, your passion leads you to your purpose. And you got rewarded for it. So the moral of the story is go for it.
It is. Yeah. And you know what? I was 40 when I did it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter that I could. What would have happened if I would have done it when I was 30? Who knows? Doesn't
right.
matter because I didn't, because I couldn't. It happened when it had to happen.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so my life came into balance when I finally decided to be who I was.
I love it.
I think they need to teach kids that. I think kids need to know that in school more than they need to know mathematics. I mean, I wish that they had that awareness or rather a philosophy to teach kids that their primary job is to discover who they are. What do they believe in, you know? And
yeah.
they, a lot of times, I mean, I wasn't the kind of parent who forced my kids into going to music or believe anything that I believe. I think it's up to them to figure that out. And a lot of parents feel like they need to indoctrinate their kids so that they live their lives through their kids. Or,
right.
I think that's destructive. You
yeah.
know? I think you need to let your kids be who they are.
Right.
And, anyway, that's just where I'm at now.
Okay. But I just want to say, Gordon. They need to know their math because they got to know their percentages and they got to know their rate. Okay,
you're right. That wasn't the best example.
I know. I just had to let it. You know, I was like, well, they need to know their math.
No,
now.
You're right. They need to know that. And you know what? My understanding of it is, in addition to knowing that, you know, how to do basic math, it also is brain calisthenics. So when you're a little, you know, when you're a high school kid, you got to exercise your brain as much as anything else. And so thinking your way through those problems is calisthenics for your brain.
Right,
so it's definitely important.
Now, I saw a name of someone.
Don't you make that the lead of the story. Gordon Goodwin says kids don't need to know math.
I know. That's going to go viral. And then they'll go to your YouTube page and listen to all your good music. So, hey, let it flow. Let it flow, brother. You know.
And there's nothing like a good scandal.
Right,
a good scandal
right.
to get yourself some attention.
Madonna said, all publicity is good publicity. So let it roll.
Yes, now, she did it.
Now,
yeah, well, she lived it too.
Yes, yeah. You know, she's the champion of it. Now, I saw a name of someone you worked with, and I absolutely love his music. I think he's really underrated. Johnny Mathis. Please tell me what it was like working with him.
Woo! It was another life-changing experience, and you know, I'm still friends with him.
Mm-hmm.
I got remarried a couple years ago. He sang at our wedding.
Oh my goodness!
And he is. We wrote a song. He's 88 years old.
Right, right.
So he would have been, you know, about 86 at that point. We recorded him. And he was like, he sounded like he was 40 years old.
Wow. I love me some Johnny Mathis.
Oh, are you kidding? And so I conducted for him. I played piano for him for about 3 years. And then I conducted and wrote arrangements for him for about two and a half years. And there's not a nicer person. He is exactly that wonderful man. He is generous. He would pay us a bonus every year.
Wow.
Back then, he paid the musicians a retainer, which meant we got paid a certain amount every week, even if we didn't do a gig.
Wow.
If he wanted us just kind of there available, he did that. And at the end of the year, if we had a good year as a company, he would give everybody a pretty bonus, and it was unheard of.
Man, thank you for sharing that story. We need to hear this stuff.
I know. I know, and I can't even believe that I could get my phone out and call him. Sometimes I go, oh, that's freaking Johnny Mathis in your phone.
I know.
But he's a wonderful person.
Man.
Yeah, and I learned so much from him. Because here's what he would do. He would go on stage every night and sing like his life depended on it.
Mm.
And I remember talking to him, because he would sing Misty, right, his big hit.
Right.
And I early on I said, hey, John, I'm going to ask you a question. So you sing Misty every night. He goes, yeah. I go, how do you do that? Every night. It's a great song, but don't you get tired of it? He goes, it's an honor to sing that song.
Oh, wow.
I said, I know. It's a great song, but every night. Because I was coming from a jazz musician thing, like, you know, we have to change it up. I mean, we have to be spontaneous. He says, look, my fans love that song. They want to hear me sing it, and I want to give them what they want. And at the time, I remember thinking, yeah, whatever.
Uh-huh.
And then I got a little older, and I put my band together, and we have a song that's pretty popular, especially with young kids. It's called The Jazz Police, and they want us to play it every gig, and I get it now.
Right.
We're kind of sick of The Jazz Police, but when we play it for these kids and they're going crazy,
uh-huh,
and, like we're the Beatles or something, I get it.
Right, right.
I get what he was saying.
How valuable it was for you to be around a seasoned professional, that your whippersnapper self was like, how you gonna sing that every night? Boy, I'd be so tired of singing that. And then the wisdom that was poured into you, even at a young age, but as you're talking and I'm hearing mm-hmm. how you just matured each decade to continue to grow, how important is that? Like, don't get stuck in your stuff.
Exactly. And get out of your own way. And, you know, when you're young, you think you know everything. But he was a real mentor for me. You know, the truth is, you got to get out there and sing like your life depended upon it every night. And you leave all your other stuff off the stage.
Mm.
Music is too important to have it be polluted with your little problems with your wife or your girlfriend or your parents or whatever it is. That stuff stays off the stage, away from the music.
Wow.
That's one thing I learned from him as well.
Wow. That's a gem.
You know what? I got to bring Johnny Mathis in. We did a Christmas record with the Count Basie Orchestra.
Wow.
And they called me and said, would you be able to call Johnny Mathis and see if he wants to sing with us? I said, oh, yeah. So I called up John. I said, have you ever sung with Count Basie? He goes, well, I've never recorded with them, but I sang one tune with them back in the 50s. So, well, would you be interested in singing on their Christmas record? And he was like, whatever you want. As long as you're there, I'll do it. I said, whoa. So I wrote an arrangement, mm-hmm. and we went to Capitol Records in Hollywood, and the guys in the Basie band were freaking out that he was there, and he was freaking out that he was with them.
Wow.
And it was such a joy to see that. But, Jerry, I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, well, how did I get here? The Count Basie band, the band that got me into music at age 15. And now
full
they
circle.
Called me to get Johnny Mathis. It's so incredible.
Yeah.
It was so incredible to see two entities that I loved, you know, interacting and making music together.
Man,
so
yeah, that's like full circle. That's like, who could have thought? Like you
it
said,
is,
like, don't quit. Like, keep going. You don't know. Right. I like the analogy you used. Is my future longer than my past? Or, like, what should I do? Mm-hmm. And like we're saying, you know, just go for it. You know, music is just, it just brings so much life. And, you know, for jazz, it's an authentic live musicianship. And so as long as you have your instrument and people who enjoy listening, you know, you're all right. You know, you never know what's going to come out of it.
The problems we're having in certain communities that can't seem to agree on whatever the issue is, I think music's the key. It's really hard to disagree if you're grooving on some tune.
That's right.
If you're connecting over something that feels good. We used to know this. The U.S. the State Department would send Dizzy Gillespie and Louis Armstrong to the Soviet Union in the height of the Cold War to do these, they called them Goodwill Ambassador Tours, and they brought jazz to the Soviet Union, and that was the key to opening up negotiations, you know, on more contentious issues, you know, like nuclear weapons or whatever. And music was the magic balm that unlocked, you know, the tight sensibilities that were going on. I talked to a guy who has an organization called Afghanistan and Iraq Veterans of America, and he basically, his organization helps soldiers that have been in combat zones in the Middle East and elsewhere. And when they come back home, sometimes they're just so traumatized and they need to be able to assimilate back into society. And he goes, there are two things I do. One is therapy dogs, and two is music.
Yeah.
He goes, and those are the two most effective things that we can use on these men that went over there and saw the most horrible stuff. They saw their, you know, friends get killed right next to them or whatever.
There are musical therapies, and mm-hmm. I mean, it's been documented how effective music is for memory and, you know, trauma, etc.
Yeah.
You talked
for
about
Alzheimer's patients too, right?
Right, and Alzheimer's patients. You talked about music being played for different causes. Where's a place that you performed? Because, you know, you're a showmanship yourself with your big fat band. Where have you played mm-hmm. that you were like, man, this was the bomb. This was it. I love this place. I would do it again. Or you may have more than one, but.
Well, there are several, but one that comes to mind is that we went and played a gig in Ukraine.
Oh, wow.
And the war was going on in the northeastern part of the country. We were in Lviv. So that was pretty far away from where the war was. I'm in this beautiful city with people that were so appreciative of what we were doing. We had 5,000 people in this big tent. And then outside the tent, they had a big video monitor. And they told us there were 10,000 people out there watching the concert. I couldn't believe it, you know.
That wow.
They were that, and they were so giving and loving. And they have three orchestra concerts like every day. In this one theater you could go to. And they're just people just like us, you know, they got their iPhones, and I'm so glad that we got to go play there before. And we were a little bit apprehensive about going at the time.
Of course, yeah.
But the war hadn't really kicked in as like it would eventually. So it's interesting how when you go to Japan and Europe and the attitude they have about jazz, they appreciate it in a way. And I think you've seen jazz musicians probably since the 50s have discovered that they are welcome in those other countries more than they are, you know, in their own country.
Of course.
A lot of them were just like Dexter Gordon. He said, oh, I'm going to go live there. I'm going to live there. These people like what I do. And
right.
You know, why fight it? So, but.
Where do you see the future of jazz going? Like with the technology, I really don't feel like there's a comparison. It could just be my ignorance of technology with jazz, except in the digital format of film and TV. But do you think, has jazz grown? Are more people receiving the genre? What are your thoughts?
One thing that makes me feel positive is, and this is our demographic and has been from the beginning, is young people, high school, middle school, high school, and college kids have embraced this music.
Oh,
now,
okay.
These are all music geeks, you know. They're band geeks is what they are. And so, but I see them embracing this music, and I don't know that it's a super large percentage compared to the people that are embracing popular music.
Right.
But it's passionate, and it's a lifelong commitment that these people make. It hasn't been easy for jazz since the beginning. It's been an uphill climb, but it's still here. And I talk to people like you and organizations like your entity that is helping
spread
doing an article, you know,
right.
on a jazz project. Because I think that all you have to do I think you have to experience it in person.
Right.
You know, the difference between hearing live music and listening on your phone. It's just so, you feel the music hits you in the chest.
Right.
You feel the air as the musicians play. That's what did it for me, actually. I went to a summer jazz camp when I was in eighth grade, and I heard a big band play, and I could feel it. And I think that's important. We need to think about this for a minute. Think about before the invention of the tape recorder. Go back to Mozart's time, say. In order to hear music, you had to actually leave your house and go seek it out.
Right.
You had to go to the town square. Maybe there'd be a little string quartet playing, or you had to go, you know. You couldn't just touch your phone and hear whatever you wanted. So music had to have been an extraordinary experience for those
people,
because they don't hear it all the time.
Right.
They had to get in their horse and buggy and go to it, you know.
Right, right.
And invest in it.
Yeah. That's what made some of the best clubs, like the Cotton Club, all those big band clubs, mm-hmm. where people got dressed up to go to see the performances.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. They got dressed up. They made a commitment to get it. And in a way, all the information that we get these days is so accessible. When I was in college and I wanted to learn something about, say I needed to get the range of the alto flute. What's the low note on the alto flute? Oh, I don't remember. I had to go to the library, and I had to kind of look through the card index and find a book, you know, and look
right,
it up.
Right.
So it took me probably 45 minutes to get that piece of information, whereas now I can get it in probably 10 seconds.
Right, right.
But I think because of that, I think the information goes in my head and goes out of my head after I've used it.
Right.
So I kind of wondered about that. I didn't have to make that same investment to acquire the information, that it was less meaningful for me. I wonder about that for young people
who
grew up in an age of computers and phones and were able to, you know, to get what they wanted at the touch of their fingertips. It'll be different. I don't know that it'll be worse. It'll certainly be different for them.
Right,
in
definitely.
In terms of how they process their experiences.
Last question. Would you consider yourself a maestro?
You know, people, when I conduct orchestras, the musicians call you maestro as a term of respect. And you know, Nigeria, it felt weird every time. It felt like it was, it distanced me from them. And a conductor of an orchestra sometimes has to be the benevolent dictator, because you've got 90 people and you're saying to them, I know you guys are all really good and very experienced, but here's how it's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
Watch me, 3, 4, boom, you know?
Right.
And so you have to have that charisma in order to do that. Yet, I never believed in trying to get what I want based on criticizing people or intimidating people. I think it's much better to, you know, I guess use honey instead of a stick, you know?
Right.
And so I felt awkward when people called me maestro. And even though I know they're trying to give it as a term of respect.
Mm-hmm. But it is. The definition is a distinguished musician, especially in conducting classical music. So it is a compliment. If the maestro has abused his power, then that's just something different.
Now, see, there you hit on it, because so many of them have abused their power. So the term has gotten hijacked a little bit, just like diva.
Right.
This is a diva. Diva was a term that wasn't necessarily meaning like a singer with attitude, you know, that was, uncooperative or difficult. It didn't always mean that, even though it could.
Right.
Same thing with maestro. And I think you hit on it. That's probably one of the reasons I resist it, because I don't want to be characterized as somebody who's ungiving or uncooperative.
Right.
But
right.
I accept it when people say it. I do accept the term.
So let's get back. As we tie this up for Ella 2, tell people how they can reach out to you, listen to your music. You have a website, social media.
Yes, ma'am.
Let them know.
My website is Big Fat Band, and that's PHAT, Big Fat Band at .com. And then I can be found on X at Gordon Goodwin, or Twitter, whatever you want to call it. I still call it Twitter.
Me too.
And there's a Big Fat Band page on Facebook, and we are also on Instagram, The Real Gordon Goodwin, and there's a Big Fat Band Instagram page as well. If people want to hear For Ella 2, it's on Spotify, and it's on YouTube, and it's on Apple Music, and all the platforms.
All right. Gordon, when I tell you this was great, and I really enjoyed speaking with you, man, thank you so much for sharing. And as I like to say, once a key player, always a key player. So when you drop a new project or you're in New York or whatever, make sure you reach out to us.
Oh, man, your questions were so great. And we got a little deeper, you know, into the weeds than some interviews do. And I loved every minute. So thank you so much.
I appreciate you.
Thanks again for your time.